Okay, so my name is John Beck, and with my colleague Kurt Dewhurst, and maybe I should use this so that it actually records. With my colleague Kurt Dewhurst, I co-direct Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. And Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives has been around for basically about 25 years. And in that time, we've done exhibits, film openings, poetry and fiction readings, concerts, and we're in the, what do I keep on saying? Is this the 22nd year of the Brown Bag series, Kurt? I think it's 22nd. Pretty close. And we've had wonderful brown bags over the years. So just passing out this spring's brown bag. So feel free to take one of those and just pass the whole pile back. Our next one is next Monday in this very room. Ellen Schott-Schneider from Departments of Anthropology and History here at MSU will be talking about the Empire's Little Sisters, Labor and Emotion of Wartime Japan. This is a fascinating talk. This is basically about geishas who were young women who were trained to be supportive for kamikaze pilots. And so I think you'll find that to be interesting. Then exactly the week later, we're going backwards in time from World War II back to World War I. Our current exhibit in the main gallery, the big gallery, is on World War I posters in support of the war and against sedition and other things. So Shirley Vida is going to be doing who is the curator on that, is going to be doing a talk called A War of Words, Labor and Anti-Radical Propaganda During World War I. Wouldn't miss it. Do come out for that. And last but not least, I don't have the color version for you, but I have in wonderful black and white the flyer for our Mother Jones return tour. Mother Jones, in the person of Karen Varange from West Virginia, did two outstanding performances last year. And this year, she's coming back for three performances, one in Lansing, one in Flint, one in Grand Rapids. And I would just don't even say no, just automatically put it in your calendar for 7 o'clock, March 12th, down at Local 602 of the UAW, free, open to the community, everyone is invited, so do come. Now there are handy dandy sign-in sheets, so please do sign in if you haven't already signed in. So let me, Candace can introduce herself more as we go along, but it's been my pleasure to work with Candace Keller for some time now on various things connected to the Department of Art, Art History, and Design. And Candace currently has an exhibit on the ground floor, which is on Malian photography. Mali, as we're about to find out from Candace, is not unlike other places like the United States, where photography played a very, very special role in relation to really the image of certain occupations, both as the photography as an occupation, but also the use of photographs, often with occupational tools and other things. Here in America, it goes back to daguerreotypes, even of the 19th century. And we're going to hear all about Mali. I was lucky enough to have a two-year project going back and forth to Mali. Fascinating place, and Candace is going to really give us a glimpse of what that looks like in the image of photography. In her talk today here at Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, Imaging Work, Photography in Mali, West Africa. So please give a hand to Candace Keller.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for attending this talk. As John mentioned, my name is Candace Keller. I'm a historian of African art and visual culture in the Department of Art, Art History, and Design. My research since 2002 has focused on histories of photographic practice, both in Mali and in West Africa. And usually my work, it covers the 1880s all the way to the present, several generations and practices of photography, but looking at the work that photographers do through social concepts and local theoretical ideas that photographers use to explain their work, and also the aesthetic choices that they make and strategies that they employ to visually underscore certain ideas in their work. And some of that will come out a little bit today, but mostly today I'm trying to talk about photography in Mali through the work that photographers do, the social roles that they play to a certain degree, just a snapshot of that, and then also the way in which work, labor, and that aspect of people's identities have been portrayed in portraiture as part of the work that photographers do. I'm going to start my timer up here, so hopefully everything stays functioning properly, although it doesn't seem to want to start. So maybe not. Maybe, John, if you could just let me know. Thank you. All right, sounds good. All right, so the title of my talk has two meanings: imaging work, so the work that photographers do, and then also imaging work, images of relating to people's labor. In case you're not familiar with Mali, this is where it's situated in West Africa. Most of the photographers that I'll be talking about and the photographs that I'll show you are from Bamako, the capital city, but some are also from Mopti, a little ways up the river, and it's the environs of Bamako. So my work, I've worked with over 150 photographers over the past 15 years, and one of the photographers that I've worked most closely with, Malik Sidibe, maybe the most acclaimed and renowned photographer of all time, who unfortunately passed away in April of 2016. So you'll see him and his narrative pop up in here, as well as others. Many of you may know that photography was introduced to the world in 1839, but it wasn't practiced by African photographers until the 1850s. That's the earliest example that we know of is Augustus Washington, who was actually a freed slave who became a well-known photographer in the U.S. and then came to Monrovia in 1853 and started working as a professional photographer, traveling around through different cosmopolitan coastal cities. And then by the 1860s in Ghana, present-day Ghana, a lot of studios started to be opened up by African practitioners. In the inland areas of French West Africa, like present-day Mali, photography did not arrive until the 1880s, so several decades later, in the hands of French military expeditions, by and large. Later, you'll have French colonial administrators and missionaries and others practicing photography, but the earliest examples were these expeditions where photography was used to document the river system, particularly the Bani and the Niger River, and as well as local natural resources, the flora, fauna, botany, herbal medicine. In fact, one of the earliest photographers, Jules Garnier, who taught some of the early photographers that I'm going to introduce to you today, was a botanist, and he worked with the French colonial administration to document what would become pharmaceuticals around Bamako and in some rural areas. So this was the first introduction, and most of these photographs focused on, as I said, documenting natural resources, but also documenting development that the French were doing as part of their mission civilisatrice. So they were building railroads and bridges and dams and buildings and other sorts of infrastructure. And so they were primarily documenting these are photographs by a French photographer who was based in Senegal, Edmond Fortier, and then also documenting types of culture groups, you know, trying to classify people into different types of culture that could be identified and labeled, and so that these individuals are not being captured as individuals. Their names are not being recorded, but in this case, they're representative of Laobe or Fula by focusing on the hairstyles, the clothing, the accessories, and so on, and often in profile and frontal photographs. By the 1930s, some French photography studios were opening up, mostly to support the French community, expat community that was in the capital city of Bamako. At the same time, some African photographers in Mali, what was then the French Sudan, were becoming introduced to the technology, largely through French military officers and other members of the French administration, and in some cases through these photographers who were starting to open up photo studios. The equipment that they were able to obtain was by and large secondhand, 19th century large view cameras that you see here, which originally would have used glass plate negatives and then later large plate celluloid film. Smaller technology, more handheld medium format technology wasn't popular until the late 1950s, early 1960s. So by and large, most of the photographs that I show you up to the 60s were taken with this kind of camera, which used sunlight, you know, had a very slow development rate, so people had to stay still very long, which explains some of the stiffness of the early photos. A lot of the equipment, again, it was secondhand that the photographers, Malian photographers, would get from colonial men who were going back to France and were offloading this heavy equipment and selling it to them. So in the case of one of the photographers, I'll show you, Seydou Keita, he inherited one that the shutter was broken, so he had to use the lens cap for 3 seconds at a time and sort of master this. And they were both taking photographs and printing photographs using sunlight. While they refer to their establishments as studios, by and large these were in their domestic courtyards, so they didn't have a dedicated building with a name out front. It was more word of mouth. People would know to come and see them. And in some cases, more than one photographer might live in the same compound and share the same studio space within the outdoor courtyard of their home. And so there are different ways through which photographers came to the profession. One of the earliest photographers, Mintaga Dambele, in the 1930s, he was actually a well-educated man in Bamako. His family had ties to the colonial administration, and he was a primary education teacher in the area, but he also was conscripted into the military for World War II. He was in the Tirailleurs Sénégalais, the French West African military that participated in World War II, and he practiced photography overseas. With the French. And I'm showing you here, he's standing with his Imperature Enlarger, which was a rare thing in Mali at the time. The French studios that I mentioned that started opening up in the 1930s would have enlargers, but most of the African practitioners that were using the large view cameras like this, they were using direct printing. So they would just have the negative and the paper exposed in the sunlight. They didn't use enlargers, didn't have access to enlargers. So in 1945, when the war was over and he was coming back, he ordered an Imperature enlarger, and it arrived in 1947 in Bamako. So two years wait on that. But once it came, it revolutionized his profession, his business, not only for him, but also for people like Seydou Keita, who was his neighbor and who also worked with him in his courtyard studio and used this enlarger. Other photographers like Baru Kone, he was an electrician, a carpenter, and a blacksmith, and he was able to forge his own enlarger. He created one out of local materials, and so he too was one of few in Bamako at this time who had their own enlarger. And again, because of it, it became sort of a nexus of local photography where people, he trained a lot of the next generation, and he also apprenticed with some of the French photographers like Pierre Garnier, which I'll talk about in a second. He was also very well connected with young up-and-coming leaders who were engaged in the local politics At the time, during the colonial era, sort of the anti-colonial pan-African socialist government of the Rassemblement Démocratique Africain, the party and labor unions, he was well connected, and so were most of these photographers at the time. Actually, they were politically connected and also networked among other photographers at the time, because it was a rather small and important community. This is Seydou Keita, who I mentioned before, one of the first generation photographers, probably the most famous first generation photographer from Mali, but also famous from Africa in general. He passed away in 2001 and practiced photography from the 1940s, 1948 is really when he started, and then started working for the government, the national government, taking photographs of like mugshots of people who had been arrested at the headquarters, when he had to stop his studio business, because at the time you couldn't run both your own private enterprise and also work for the government. So they always say that in 1977 he stopped his work, but it's partly because he was working for the government. And as I mentioned, he partially came to photography. He was a carpenter, but he came to photography two ways. One was his uncle, who was a traveling salesman, who brought a camera back from Senegal and gave it to him, so he was practicing sort of as an amateur in his young age, and then his neighbor, Muntaga Dambele, really trained him in how to take photographs and allowed him to use his infrastructure enlarger, which was really right when he started. He got it in 1947, Seydou Keita started in 1948. And another sort of nexus or hub for photographers at this time was one of those French studios that I mentioned, operated by Pierre Garnier and his mother. His father, Jules Garnier, who was the botanist I mentioned earlier, who trained a lot of photographers like Barucone, they opened this studio in 1935, and it was a studio for French, but also some African elite would come and have their portraits taken there. He hired about six or seven assistants. This is one of the first generation, this group became the first generation of photographers by and large in Bamako, trained by both Jules and Pierre Garnier, but it also was a supply store. So it's where a lot of people would come to get, a lot of the photographers would come to get their film. And in the early years, they often weren't taught how to develop film. So even if they apprenticed to the French photographers, to maintain a monopoly, that's okay. To maintain a monopoly over their role in the local photography world, the photographers like Pierre Garnier would not teach his apprentices how to develop film. So they would still have to come to him to have film developed. And only later, through word of mouth and trial and error and practicing themselves, they would learn. And I should also say, one of the reasons probably that an African market for photography didn't really start until the 30s had to do with laws. Before then, it was you had to have a permit to have a camera, a gun, or a radio. The French administration recognized the power of these tools, and so it was difficult to obtain that. But after, in 1932, the rules lessened, and so became more accessible to African photographers. I'll tell you another law in a second from 1946 that affected photography. But first, another photographer, Malik Sidi Bey, the one that I mentioned earlier with whom I worked most closely, he is a younger generation than the ones that I've shown you so far, second generation. He started practicing in the 1950s. He entered the profession through art. So he was... he grew up in a rural area. He was not born and raised in Bamako like the other photographers. He's from Solaba. I have to talk to you about apprenticeships and party photos, but hopefully you felt like you learned something interesting about the work of photographers in Mali and also how work is portrayed in photographs in Mali.
Well, first of all, before we do questions, let's give her a round of applause. I'm sure all of you have questions, because I've got plenty. And let me just start off with one and then open it up. Tell us whether or not Mali and its photography
Is it very much like other African nations or other West African nations, or were there uniquenesses to Malian photography per se?
Both. I mean, as you saw, Tijani Shitu is a Yoruba man from Nigeria, and there in the 70s were a lot of people from Nigeria and Ghana that were coming into Mali practicing as photographers and brought with them certain styles of photography. Erica Numi, who's a historian of photography, a French historian, she talks about how the Yoruba style is the painted backdrops. So the Tijani Shitu example that I showed you, but even Malik Sidibe, and that didn't really start until the 70s. But there's a lot of posture that's the same. There's a lot of shared meaning, but some things are culturally specific even. And so while there are terms in Bamanan Kam and concepts associated with these postures, there are equivalent in Yoruba. So for Tijani Shitu is an easy transition, but in other cases it's unique. Senegalese photography, you know, there are some, first of all, so much older, but there are some characteristics that are unique. The highly ornate backdrops, the black and white stripes that Malik Sidibe used so often as a signature, and Sidi Keita's five different backdrops, that's more of a Malian practice. You do see some of that elsewhere, but it's really kind of known locally in the region as a Malian practice and as a signature, so right away you know who took that photograph. So it's both.
Great. Another question? Go.
So why were you the only one smiling?
Well, because I messed up. in formal, you know, important buildings like that where you know, you're documenting an important thing like a wedding, everybody should comport themselves appropriately as serious and also not distorting their face, so it's a good record. But you know, you put a camera in front of me and I forgot and I couldn't see what everyone else was doing, so I smiled. Now they make fun of me for ruining the picture. So I was often the point of humor, especially when I danced at the wedding. Still known by the elderly ladies as the dancer. Yeah?
Kurt?
Just wonderful talk, Candice. I love your work and followed it now for a number of years, so it's great to see you. What you're doing, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where you're going next with this. What are the things that you want to do? I mean, the digital repository is amazing, and I assume that will continue to grow. And I wondered if that and what's happening back in Mali in response to this, your work.
So with regard to what I'm doing now, my book is about to come out from Indiana University Press, finally, and it just took a long time to get permission because I work with, I think there are 75 photographers represented in the book, and many of them have passed away by now, so trying to find their rural family members to get permission took a while. But it's almost out, so that's good news. And then the Archive of Malian Photography, we just submitted another large grant from the U.S. Ambassador's Fund for Cultural Heritage Preservation, so hopefully if we get that, that's a 5-year project to extend the scope, even maybe beyond Mali, because going to your question, there's a lot of exchange. A lot of the people who are pictured aren't Malian. They were traveling through on the railway line or visiting family, and the photographers were moving around too, and so to try to sort of reconnect those histories, there's a lot of grad students right now working on these deep local histories finally, so maybe we can start to put the larger picture together in time. And so that's something that we'd like to reconnect so we better understand it. And then out of that project, because now we have 100,000 negatives, I haven't looked at all of them, and it's a huge resource, so I'm trying to get, I applied for a grant to have some dedicated time to review and work on an exhibition. A large-scale traveling exhibition that would open in the U.S., France, and Mali at the same time in 2022. And so that's another part of the project. And I don't know what that's going to take. New questions and, you know, so if you know, who knows. But then I also have areas like the spiritual side of photography that I started to get into in my book, but that I have to go work with more imam and marabu, more people in Mali to really understand better, and also women. So, lots of different possibilities. As far as the response in Mali, we launched the project, the Archive Malian Photography, in May in Bamako first. The site is in French and English. And we had a press conference there, and the Malian Minister of Culture was there, the U.S. Ambassador to Mali was there, and lots of journalists and lots of photographers were there. And the response overwhelmingly was, this is important to preserve cultural heritage. We haven't historically thought about our photographs as cultural heritage, and so it's teaching us a new respect for these archives. And the young photographers who worked with us on the project now feel that they have a better understanding of how to preserve, and they lead workshops. So there's collateral effect, I guess, and also people who want to do similar projects in Ivory Coast, Burkina Faso, Senegal, and Niger have contacted the team in Bamako, and they've led workshops, and we put video up on our website, and we tried to be as transparent as possible about our process so that people who want to model or tweak our model have all the material to do so. So hopefully it's also a resource for people who do this conservation work too. And then we're always tweaking our to be more efficient and productive and better practices and so on. I hope I answered your question.
Let me try one just for the fun of it. In some American photos that I'm aware of, from portraits, people often put in what might be called signs of resistance. That is, that they, whether it be hand gestures or other kinds of things. During the colonial period, when black African photographers were on the rise, but it was still a French colony, were there kind of in effect, messages that people would, resistance that people would put into formal portraiture?
I haven't learned about that in my research. That doesn't mean that it didn't happen, but there are other forms. Like these photos that I didn't get to show you, this wasn't during the colonial era, but during the socialist era of Modibo Keita, Mali's first president. By the 1960s, most people talk about these as celebratory photos, celebrating independence, celebrating new social, pop cultural opportunities for young people to interact and to dance in new ways that formerly wouldn't have been something that people would have done, wearing shorter, more revealing clothing, Western style attire, smoking, drinking, all that sort of thing. But then, by 1965, 1967, especially when his regime got more restrictive, and he had the militia, there were curfews, you couldn't be out past 8, you weren't supposed to be caught wearing Afro hairstyles, short skirts, platform shoes, or bell-bottom pants. The markets were shut down. He was trying to emulate the soup kitchens of the Eastern Bloc in China, and rice kitchens in this case. And so all this was recalcitrant, and all this was also hidden. And so they would have been seen publicly like this. They would have had boo-boos and other traditional attire covering them. They had these very interesting secret networks through the bus transportation system of passing notes so that the girls would get the money and make the food, and then they would figure out where it was going to be, and it was all sort of last minute because they were out past curfew, engaging in music they weren't supposed to. You couldn't get this at the market anymore. They knew people who worked for Air Mali, Air France, who were truck drivers, so they smuggled a lot of the stuff in. So definitely there is this resistant movement, particularly during Modibo Keita and Moussa Traoré. It continued in his regime, but also not as strongly, but it still did. Sure, there must have been ways of resisting colonial power that they didn't agree with too, but I haven't heard of ways in which that's visually evident in photos. There are ways that women and other people send messages through their clothing, And I don't think I have, I think I pulled it out of this slide, but there's some textiles that are named about polygamous marriages and how they're not afraid of the jealous eyes of their co-wife. And sometimes they would have a new baby and wear that dress to have their portrait made, you know, making a very clear statement that, you know, I'm not afraid of you, I'm sure you're jealous. So there's lots of ways that this happens, but I don't know specifically in the colonial era of signals like that.
Other questions back here in the corner?
Yeah, this is great stuff. So much of what you've talked about rings so true. The photographer I know best is a Coolie girl, and not a huge thriving metropolis, and probably the tailor across the street was one of his best friends, and I hadn't really given much thought to that symbiosis, but I'm sure you're absolutely right. Besides being the projectionist in the theater, because the films were all breaking and so he has to know how to fix them, but his bread and butter was ID photos.
Yeah.
And because that's where the ferry comes up and down in Niger, there were a lot of people who were going to need that ID photo. And it was a rare treat for him to have the opportunity to do the portrait work.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I'm curious if you run across many of the photographers having kind of that baseline business of more utilitarian, kind of, I do ID photos, and then the portraiture, the kind of the cream of the
I would say both ID photos and portraiture for most of the urban areas like Bamako, but then even sort of Mopti and Segu, it was both ID photos and portraiture. I haven't worked at some of the smaller areas. Like I haven't been to Kulukoro. I was in Sukasso, and there's a photographer well known named Kai. I haven't made it out there yet either. So you're right. You know, there could be these particularities in specific locations where it's a thoroughfare and people are more concerned with identification photo than they are with portraiture. But I tell you, since the late 1970s, early 1980s, when color and portraiture photography started becoming a 35mm, it became ID photos entirely for if a photography business wanted to maintain itself, pretty much portraiture was much less of something that people were seeking, and they were only going for ID photo because you still had to have a black and white medium format. Then it became video. So, you know, the young apprentices then would, instead of taking photos out of reportage, more and more they were doing video. And now with digital, it's all over the place because most of the identification photos are supposed to be digital, and so most of the like the police and other governmental agencies are starting to take that side over. There's more digital labs that have opened since 2009, so that's a more viable thing. A lot of studios are transitioning over to digital, so we're in this moment of change. But to be considered an art photographer now with all this attention from the outside, particularly on Mali, which has a biennial of photography since 1994, which brings lots of people from the outside in, artists, curators, designers, and so on. A lot of young photographers want to work in black and white medium format specifically because it is considered serious and artistic as opposed to commercial or everyday. So yeah, there's a lot of variety, and women since the 1990s have now. There's more and more, you know, there's probably 200 women photographers working in Bamako alone, both for national press and also their own studios and video reporting. So a lot of things have changed. That's a long way to your comment. Yeah.
Candace, I do, you know, just loved your project for so many years. But so now he's hearing me talk about those textiles.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I just wondered, are you doing any collecting of textiles, and are there collections being formed that would then be great, you know?
Tangible. I like where you're going.
Yes,
I have collected over the years, but I saw a show from Lisco, this Dutch, probably, you know, from the 19th century till now, the most important, arguably, finest quality wax print cloth, so sometimes misnomer African print cloth, but Dutch wax or lost wax. I saw a show, and a lot of the, like the dark jealous eyes of my co-wife cloth that I mentioned was in that show. I didn't realize it was still being made. You can't get it locally. So I had this idea that it would be so interesting to have a show of the portraits with the fabric, because all of a sudden now you're translating black and white into what it was and how the photographers were translating the color.
Even one more step. The garment made from the fabric.
Exactly, and then to talk about those names, and then when they were used, and the history, and sort of complicate it. So, yeah, I want to do an exhibition of that at some point, because I think that would be really interesting. Well, maybe we could collaborate.
Let me ask a question, Candace. Did black photographers shoot white subjects?
Once in a while. So they will tell you, many of them who I spoke with, they will all tell you there was so much racism that the reason that French photographers hired black photographers was to take portraits of their black clientele. That's what they will tell you. But that's not always the case. There's many cases like Abderman Sokoli, who was Moroccan, a heritage, came to Mali through Senegal and was working in the 50s, probably one of the most famous locally at that time. He was taking pictures for the French administration, going to their parties at the Grand Hotel, taking pictures of portraits of French and German, and you know, and even Malik Sidibe too. You could see it in his work. It wasn't as common with Abderman Sokoli. It was quite common. He would do both. But many photographers talked about the racism and talked about like the reason that Sadie Keita was, or sorry, Malik Sidibe was hired by Gigi Le Pellicule at Photo Service, Malik argued was because he would take on the French reportage, or sorry, the African reportage for his establishment because French didn't want to be photographed by black photographers. And there's some interesting photos. I've since befriended Gigi Le Pellicule. He's in his 90s, he's still alive, and he sent me all his materials. Another thing that I need to do is go through that. This was just last year. But there's photos in the studio, and you can see how Malik Sidibe and his another Malian collaborator taking pictures of white women, but using different backdrops, taking pictures of African, using specific backdrops. And then when the French would take pictures of French, totally different. And then you would see around the room all this National Geographic style photography of Africans. So it's really complicated in terms of the ideas and the ways that people worked. And so that's another part of the project I want to get more nuanced with by studying those images more in depth.
Other questions? Marsha?
Sort of like along the same line of what you're asking, John, is are there any areas of photography that you see, or subjects or types of events that are omitted from what you're, this big body of data you now have, that you might see in a non-African photographer's or?
Yeah, photos of dead people.
That's what?
For example.
Yeah.
And that's specific to Mali, not necessarily specific, because it, like in Nigeria or Ghana, there's a long tradition, or in Dahomey, there's a long tradition of taking pictures of the nearly dying or dead. So it has probably more to do with Islam, but not only. I have a chapter on this in my book, by the way, where I talk about the Bamanan Kantar, Jah, and what the devil means and why they don't turn photos of dead in Mali.
I also noticed that, well, when I think of like studios in the US, I would assume that they get a huge proportion of their income from family portraits, like couples or especially kids. Weddings too, but, and I didn't see any like sort of nuclear families or like kids. Is that a lot?
A lot of that.
Okay, so they do that.
Privileged, specific things that I guess I felt like I could talk about. But yeah, there's a lot of, both nuclear and polygamous households. Yeah, and there's ones where multiple wives are wearing. I'm not afraid of the jealous guys and my co-wives lot in one photo, so it's interesting, yeah.
Let me ask one question about the sewing machine photos. Did anyone actually then turn around and use those in print with newspaper ads or other things that you're aware of?
Not necessarily the photos with the sewing machines, but yes, photos that were taken, particularly, so, boy, this is you've unlocked Pandora's box with this one, but there were a lot of these photographers who also worked for the National Press, and also the Colonial Press. And so a lot of those photos cross boundaries. So they could appear in print in newspapers, they could appear just as a postcard, they could appear as a portrait, personal photo. So yes, there were, sometimes the same image can move in different markets. Sometimes they were different, different jobs that they were taking on, and so those photos would end up in different places. And sometimes it would be the studio photographers, like in the case of Tijani Shitu and Mumuni Kone, both worked for the police taking accident photos, and those would appear in the newspaper too. Like a car drove into the movie theater, and there's a photo that he took that ended up in, so, and I found them. And it wasn't just newspapers, but also Presence Africaine and other Francophone journals and things that were popular magazines at the time. You would see these photographers' works published in.
So now we know that the drive-in theater was invented in Mali, is what you're telling us.
Yes, that was an unfortunate event.
Well, two quick things. First of all, if you haven't signed in, please sign in. But now, please give one warm, big round of applause for that wonderful presentation by Candace.
Thank you for your excellent questions.
Next Monday, come back. The Monday after, come back, and do come see Mother Joan.